Versa Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Lori London reporting. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump and Democratic rival Hillary Clinton unleashed some of their harshest criticisms about each other a day after a televised forum on national security put each under the spotlight. Appearing at a school in Cleveland, Ohio, Trump said Clinton is unfit to be commander-in-chief.
I think the main thing is I have great judgment. I have good judgment. I know what's going on. I've called so many of the shots. And I happened to hear Hillary Clinton say that I was not against the war in Iraq. I was totally against the war in Iraq. You can look at Esquire magazine from 2004. You can look at before that.
Clinton telling a rally in Charlotte, North Carolina, that Trump's comments about Russian President Vladimir Putin is a far more of a leader than President Barack Obama shocked her.
He praised Russia's strongman, Vladimir Putin, even taking the astonishing step of suggesting that he prefers the Russian president to our American president.
Trump and Clinton will square off in their first presidential debate on September 26th. South Korea's news agency says European monitoring agencies are reporting a 5.0 magnitude quake in North Korea. No confirmation, but they are suspecting it was a nuclear test. California and federal regulators fined Wells Fargo Bank a combined $185 million on Thursday, alleging the bank's employees illegally opened millions of unauthorized accounts for their customers in order to meet aggressive sales goals. The San Francisco-based bank will pay restitution as well to the affected customers. This is VOA. Despite the shrinking of Islamic State-held territory in Iraq and Syria, the head of the Central Intelligence Agency is stressing that the group's influence is not going away anytime soon. CIA Director John Brennan on Wednesday, addressing a national security summit in Washington, said the lasting impact of foreign fighters possibly attempting to return to their home countries. Intelligence officials acknowledge that dismantling the IS caliphate now will likely have wider repercussions and present broader challenges for law enforcement as a whole. Jobs, social justice, and security are the main issues people in the Middle East and North Africa are still hoping for 5 years after the start of the Arab Spring. But new research shows a change in European Union policy toward Arab countries is needed to limit economic migration to Europe and further stabilization of the region. Martha van der Wolf reports for VOA from Brussels.
The European Union can play a crucial role in stabilizing the Middle East and North Africa region and reducing migration flows if its policies focus more on fighting political and socio-economic injustice. Those are some of the conclusions the European Commission-funded Arab Transformation Project presented Thursday in Brussels. Arab Transformations Project Director Andrea Tetti says EU policy does not focus on the root causes, which can further destabilize the already volatile region.
So we prioritize anti-terrorism operations, domestic security, the question of migration, social and economic inequality. They don't succeed in addressing giving people more political voice. So we recreate conditions that create political radicalization.
Demonstrators in several Middle Eastern and North African countries voiced their frustrations about unemployment, bad governments, and social injustice during the Arab Spring mass protest in 2011. Several governments were toppled, but 5 years later, political and economic conditions have barely improved, while insecurity has increased. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Brussels.
The first NASA explorer of its kind took off on a seven-year quest Thursday, chasing after a big black unexplored asteroid dubbed Bennu to gather a few handfuls of gravel for return to Earth. Greg Redfern is NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab ambassador.
Cirrus Rex will arrive at Bennu probably a year or two from now. Bennu is about the size of 5 football fields. Oh, by the way, it's going to re-enter Earth at 27,700 miles an hour, so it's going to light up the skies when it comes back in.
Round trip, the SUV-sized spacecraft will travel more than 6 billion kilometers by mission's end. This is VOA.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Friday, September 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Gabon's opposition presidential candidate challenges the results of the August 27 elections in court.
We are challenging the result of Otogwe, the native province of Mr. Bongo, in which he has won the province with 95.6% of the voting.
Paul-Marie Ganjou represents opposition leader Jean Ping's party on the Gabon Elections Commission. Ghanaian police deploy special measures to prevent electoral violence ahead of the country's December elections. A conference to combat religious extremism in Sudan has ended in the capital, Khartoum, and expanding internet access in Africa.
Our plan is to make basic internet services affordable so that everyone with a phone can join the knowledge economy. In order for this to be economically feasible, we need to make the internet 100 times more affordable.
That's Facebook founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg. We'll look at the impact of fewer veterinarians on the ability to track zoonotic diseases in Liberia. And the son of a Nigerian immigrant fulfills a dream of being an aerobatic pilot. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Gabonese opposition leader Jean Ping on Thursday asked the country's constitutional court to review the results of the August 27 presidential election, particularly those from President Ali Bongo's home province of Hautogwe. Paul-Marie Ganjou, who represents Mr. Ping's party on the Elections Commission, says the international community, including UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, encouraged Mr. Ping to contest the results. The Elections Commission said Mr. Bongo won re-election with 49.8% of the vote, while Ping had 48.23%. The commission said 99.9% of Hautogwe took part in the vote, and 95% of them voted for Mr. Bongo. Ganjou says Mr. Ping wants the court to look into why there was such a high turnout in Hautogwe when the overall national participation on Election Day was 59%.
We are challenging the result of Otogwe, the native province of Mr. Bongo, in which he has won the province with 95.6% of the voting. On the 99.93 level of participation of the voters, which is completely a nonsense.
So let me ask you, this is Gabon that the Bongo family has ruled for so long. Do you have any trust in the Gabonese legal system, the judicial process?
We have no trust in this constitutional court for many reasons. First, the president of this court, Mrs. Boranchou, is the mother of two children of Mr. Bongo, the father. So Ali Bongo is the brother of Mrs. Boranchou children. This link between both of them makes us to not trust what she could do for this complaint. And we used to observe that from Mr. and Mrs. Boranchou, she always do the same thing. I mean, decide for the president. She did the same thing for the complaint about his birth certificate. We have no confidence on this court also because all the members of this court has been named by the PDG party, Parti Democratique Gabonais, which is the party in charge of the country.
I hear what you say. So really, the challenge to the Constitutional Court is a matter of formality. You don't expect any good results to come out of there that will overturn the election results. So why go there?
Like I said, in this political environment, we are not alone. You have the people, you have the international community, you have many people around us. I mean, for us, the president-elect. But if we have a position not to go to this court because we know what will happen from this court, but we cannot also forget that around of us, the people in the international community, urge us to go to the court. And we want the international community to help us in the resolution of this crisis. They want us to go to the court. So we went to the court. If not, what will happen in this country will be a civil war. That's all we can say.
You said that Mr. Ping wants the international community to intervene. The UN Secretary General and perhaps the African Union also have been talking to both President Bongo and Mr. Ping. Is the UN Secretary General advising Mr. Ping or told Mr. Ping to go to the Constitutional Court to challenge the results?
Mr. Ban Ki-moon asked Mr. Ping to go to the Constitutional Court. Mr. Jean-Marc Ayrault, the French Minister of Foreign Affairs, asked Mr. Ping to go to the Constitutional Court. Some African head of state did the same thing with Mr. Ping. Probably they have a kind of plan, I don't know, but they did it. I just wanted to add something very quickly. This political crisis is very dangerous at this time. That is the reason why we want the international community to intervene in Gabon, because things can go, worse after that if nothing is done.
Paul-Marie Gonjou represents opposition leader Jean Ping's party on the Gabon Elections Commission. He was speaking with me from the capital, Libreville. Ghana police have deployed special measures to prevent violence across the country ahead of the December 7th general election. This came after the police say they have identified over 5,000 hotspots of potential violence. Ghana's Electoral Commission had warned there could be violence in 81 of the 275 constituencies during the election process. Police spokesman Cephas Alpha told VOA's Peter Clotty that areas the police have identified as heavily concentrated hotspots will be divided into smaller zones to make it easier for officers to control.
We have identified some 5,000 polling stations to be flashpoints, 5,000 out of 29,000. And for that matter, already our measures to forestall any disturbances have already been activated. And the first one is intelligence. Our intelligence officers are already sent afield to pick pieces of information that we can assess and ensure that we put some measures in place to deal with them. Then we also are going to ensure that places that are tagged flashpoints or hotspots are adequately policed on the day of the election or a few days leading up to on the day of election and days after the election. Areas with high concentration of flashpoints or hotspots are going to be demarcated into smaller zones and patrol teams put in charge of these areas.
Security experts, and including the police, have cautioned that the proliferation of small arms within the country, coupled with terror activities in the sub-region, as well as chieftaincy disputes, have been identified as easy or possible easy triggers for violence. How is the police trying to deal with such?
It's a kind of an early warning that our attention was being drawn to. But I can assure you that every effort is being made to ensure that these small arms are mopped up and taken away from those who are holding them. We are also embarking on public education to ensure that people who are forging these small arms in the villages and the nooks and crannies of the cities are identified and then dealt with or dissuaded from forging small arms. So that issue can be put to rest, I can assure you. But on the issue of conflict, chieftaincy dispute and conflict, they are the indicators that we put together to tag any particular place as a flashpoint or not. Places that have issues or cases of chieftaincy disputes occurring present a fertile ground for electoral offenses, electoral crimes, and electoral radicalism. And so when we see any place like that, then we term or we designate polling stations at those places as flashpoints. We also look at places like where we have conflict, ethnic conflicts. Such places also present very good cases for radicalism during elections. So we also put them in the categories of flashpoints. Then we also look at areas that have violent crimes, like maybe robbery and other things. We look at them and say, okay, this can also present a very good case for electoral radicalism. But the main indicator for tagging any place as a flashpoint is the antecedent of electoral violence in those places, areas that have history of electoral violence.
Cephas Arthur is the spokesman for the Ghana Police. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Accra. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Friday, September 9th. Let's send shout out to listeners on our VOA affiliate station, Diamond FM in Tamale, Ghana. Daybreak Africa time is 15 and a half minutes past the hour. The Sudan National Commission for Countering and Preventing Extremism wrapped up a two-day workshop this week aimed at developing strategies to combat violent extremism in Sudan and the Horn of Africa. The workshop reached a consensus on the need to engage young people who are vulnerable to religious extremism. Nabil Biagio reports from Khartoum.
The workshop at the Khartoum Hotel brought together United Nations officials, academics, local and international NGOs, as well as representatives from the Horn and Eastern Africa. Mohammed Jamal is the Director General at Sudan's National Commission for Countering Terrorism.
The reason why we are consulting people, we would like this strategy is to come from the root, to come from the people, to come from the component of the community itself.
Jamal says Sudan is one of the countries in the region directly affected by terrorism and violent extremism. He says one case in point is the dozens of university medical students in Khartoum who left their studies last year to join the Islamic State in Syria.
We are touched by this violent extremism in a way or another because, you see, we have got some or many youth who just left their universities and they're very brilliant and very, you see, outstanding, you see, students. They went and because of lack of knowledge and lack of, you see, many, I think that lack of even the peaceful environment.
Jamal says intellectuals and civil society members must open channels of dialogue with young people who might be attracted to extremism.
What we would like to do at the end of the day, we'll try to develop this strategy with the collaboration of, you see, the United Nations and the regional organizations and the international also organizations so that we can have one concrete document with good, you see, factors of recommendations so that it could be flexible and be realistic because actually we need, at the end of the day, programs that we can put on the ground in the field there to be implemented.
Youth activist Tariq Abdullah says poverty and lack of opportunities are to blame for many young Sudanese being attracted to extremism. He says the ideology of the Khartoum regime and its harsh policies also make for fertile grounds for violent extremism.
Unemployment is one reason and the general economic situation. Another thing is the ideology of the Islamic ruling National Congress Party that leads to extremism and gives freedom to fundamentalist groups to operate Sudan.
Abdullah says if the Sudan government is serious about combating terrorism, they should stop enabling it. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio.
There are less than a handful of veterinarians working in Liberia, which affects the country's ability to track zoonotic diseases. According to Erin Reisman, a senior animal health officer at the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, there is possibly only one trained Liberian veterinarian in the entire country. Reisman says this means Liberia does not have the capacity to vaccinate or monitor animal illnesses, which also impact public health. He tells Ricky Stryak that one solution to this problem would be to send Liberian agriculture and livestock students to neighboring countries to train as veterinarians and then returning to their country to practice.
Well, following the series of civil war that were in Liberia, practically there is no national veterinarian at all. The Ministry of Agriculture used a consultant from Ethiopia as a veterinarian. She's the only veterinarian in the ministry. But rather than that, there's no veterinarians in the ministry. Veterinaries Without Borders from US, that it's a kind of organization that... Well, leadership guy from UC Davis and also from Washington State University. They worked in Liberia and sent the person, they sent him to a veterinary school, but this was only one.
Why is this important to public health in general?
It's matter not only because of public health, but if we talk specifically on public health, for the simple reason that 65 of human diseases are from animal origin, and or what we call zoonotic diseases. So if you want to control zoonotic diseases or if you want to improve human health, you need veterinarians.
You said 65% of diseases are zoonotic diseases?
Yes, yes. 65% of human diseases are from animal origin. Some people will say that it's more than 65. I'm humble and I'm saying only 65. But definitely it's a substantial percent of diseases that are related to animals or livestock. And this is why a functional veterinary service is essential for sustainable control of diseases.
I'd imagine it affects food security as well.
Well, absolutely. I mean, from beyond the public health, I think that food security in sub-Saharan Africa depends a lot on livestock.
How can these veterinarian services, how important are they to stopping the spread of disease, whether it be in animals or in people?
Veterinary services are the key in terms of leadership in conducting surveillance for diseases. Whether it starts from community animal health worker or private or para-veterinarians, it will always need to end up in the communication line with the veterinary services. And this will allow early detection of a disease and early response for a disease.
That was Erin Reisman, a senior animal health officer at the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Rome. Anthony Oshinuga, the son of Nigerian immigrants, runs an air tour company in California and has realized his childhood dream of becoming an aerobatic pilot. Mike O'Sullivan spoke with him about his love of flying.
Anthony Oshinuga can often be found in his pet special aircraft flying loops and rolls. He set his sights on flying at the age of 5 when visiting an airport.
And so I was taken by what was going on. I told my father, that's exactly what I want to do.
His parents came from Lagos, Nigeria.
I was born in Austin, Texas, so I'm the first generation to be out here in the United States. All my family, all my immediate family is back home in Nigeria.
With his small tour company called Air Oshinuga, he flies over the wine country of Temecula, California, north of San Diego.
We're a wine aerial scenic company, so basically we partner with two big wineries in the area. We provide clients with 30-minute scenic aerial flights over to Temecula, and then we land, and then they go down there and do wine tasting.
He first entered national flying competition in 2014.
And that's when I went to the U.S. National Aerobatic Championships, and I placed fourth out of 25 competitors. So since then, things have been really blossoming in the arena of aerobatics and air shows and air racings.
He loves the sense of freedom.
It's the fact of you're free in three dimension, in the three dimensions. So, you know, up, down, left, right, you know, yawing left and right. So you're pretty much free. You can do anything you want to do. And you can't get that freedom walking on the planet.
Shinuga studied engineering, but his first love is flying. And he plans to stay aloft as long as he can. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Temecula, California.
Efforts to increase internet connectivity in Africa suffered a spectacular blow earlier this month when a telecommunications satellite blew up on a launch pad in Florida. The social media company Facebook planned to use its share of the satellite's bandwidth to help get more of Africa online. Other efforts are in the works to help improve the region's lagging internet access, but it will take time, VOA Steve Baragona reports.
Faiz Bashir is CEO of FlexiSaf, an educational technology company based in Abuja. He says for most Nigerians, the full power of the internet is out of reach.
If you want very good internet, it's really expensive and usually only big companies and rich people can afford that.
One in four people in Africa will use the internet this year, according to the International Telecommunication Union. That's up from one in five last year, but it's still the lowest rate in the world. 3 years ago, social media company Facebook launched a plan to get more people in Africa and other underserved parts of the world online. Founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg outlined the plan in a Facebook video.
Our plan is to make basic internet services affordable so that everyone with a phone can join the knowledge economy. In order for this to be economically feasible, we need to make the internet 100 times more affordable.
One part of that plan launched in Nigeria in May. It's called Free Basics. Anyone with a smartphone can access certain websites for free, such as health, education, weather, job search, and some other sites. And, of course, Facebook. Bashir says relatives in isolated parts of Nigeria are now easier to reach than ever.
You can actually communicate via WhatsApp, have access to Facebook. You know, so there's definitely a large number of people now that have access to free internet, you know, from remote locations across the country.
Free Basics is now available in 48 countries in Africa, the Middle East, Asia Pacific, and Latin America. Facebook is also rolling out a service called Express Wi-Fi, where users pay a fee for access to a Wi-Fi hotspot. The company planned to expand its services. But the September 1st explosion, captured by USLaunchReport.com, set those plans back. It's not the only setback Facebook has suffered this year. In February, India's telecommunications agency chief, R.S. Sharma, announced new rules that basically shut down Free Basics there. Net neutrality advocates cheered. They said Facebook should not serve as a gatekeeper for what parts of the internet users could access. It's not clear how many new internet users Free Basics is creating. An advocacy group, the Alliance for an Affordable Internet, looked at users of Free Basics and other so-called zero-rated services in eight countries. It found that 88% had been online before, says research manager Dhanaraj Thakur.
The people that were using the zero-rated services were not using the internet for the first time. What was happening, in fact, was that they were using it as a way of managing their costs.
People were using Free Basics to check Facebook, for example, and using their data plans to watch videos. Still, Facebook says it's committed to getting the world online. Last month, it announced a successful test of a solar-powered drone designed to stay aloft for weeks and bounce internet access to remote areas. Meanwhile, Google's Project Loon aims to connect isolated users through a network of huge balloons floating in the stratosphere. Both projects are years from reality. No word yet on whether Facebook plans to try another satellite launch in the meantime. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
And that's it for this Friday, September 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. Join us again Monday for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Jamie Cook, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good weekend.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth one-on-one conversation with Namibian president. The wide-ranging discussion will include the president's vision for the future of the Southern African nation. That's next, right here on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kHz.